see. Is this turned on? Good. It's good to have all of you in class. Does everyone have a copy of our outline for this morning? These are being passed out by these gentlemen here. Brother Tucker needs one over here. George and some more people right in here. Okay. I like the way that you're sitting. One of the concerns that was voiced to me about this class is that if we weren't careful, we would spread out too far. And so I appreciate you consolidating or compressing into this area right here. It will make for a better class, and also I think it will enhance our talk in class. When people make comments, I want everyone to be able to hear. Now, if you do not have a notebook binder and you want one to collect all of these lessons for the year, there are more binders back there. In addition, if you do not have last week's material, there are extra copies of that on the front pew right here, up here, and you can get that after class today. We have some right over here who need it. George, thank you. You know, I think that we are more familiar with the Pentateuch probably than we are the majority of the Old Testament. The Pentateuch, meaning five, is the first five books of the Old Testament. They are written by Moses. The book of Exodus, as close as Adam Clark can figure it, was involved the time frame of 1639 to 1490 B.C. And that seems just about right. If you remember that biblically, the life of the earth from creation till now is roughly 6,000 years, then that seems just about right. I would encourage you, as you're collecting books, that one of the advantages of having Adam Clark's commentary is that he does a terrific job with dates. Any of you have copies of Adam Clark? Arnold does. Roy does. Up in the top of each page, he will put his, sometimes an educated guess, and sometimes he has kings and others to date off of, but that's a pretty neat feature in that commentary. Egypt had been settled by Ham's descendants. When you think about the land of Goshen, I want you to think about Egypt, because that's where the land of Goshen is. As we leave the book of Genesis, Joseph and Jacob die, plus, the Bible says, and this is very interesting to me, a whole generation. Now you have a new generation. Did we miss anybody with the outline? Raise your hand if you've been missed. Good. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Look at Exodus chapter 1 and verse 6. Exodus 1, 6. Joseph died and all his brethren and all that generation. There is nearly a 300-year gap between Genesis and Exodus. And now you have the descendants of Jacob making up a tremendous number. We know that there are at least 600,000 men. You know, that's only the men. I don't know how many people there were, but there were a tremendous number by the time of the book of Exodus. And so we start with, on your outline, the Exodus, the first 18 chapters. It is first projected. Now, here's the problem, is that there arose a king in Egypt which knew not Joseph. That is huge, because the respect that was had for Joseph and his people no longer exists. Now they're just a people that dwells in Egypt. And they have grown to such a number that they seem to pose somewhat of a threat. What's going to happen? if one of our enemies comes along and convinces this Hebrew nation to revolt against us, what then? Well, they would, there's so many of them, they would destroy us. We've got to do something. And so the choice that was made was to make them slaves. We will make slaves out of them. And we'll have taskmasters over them. And we'll have them to build Pharaoh treasured cities, Python and Ramses. It went on so far as that the decision was made to go ahead and halt the increase of men by killing the male babies. It takes your breath away, doesn't it? When a baby is born in China right now, if it is a girl, there's a good chance that she will be destroyed. In this time, if it was a boy, there was, in all likelihood, the probability that he would be destroyed. That was the intent of the Pharaoh. It is very interesting to read how some of that was thwarted by people who feared God. You can't read that without thinking about where America is right now in reference to abortion, and remembering that in Proverbs 6, the Bible says that God hates those who shed innocent blood. It was true then, it's true now. So during this time of awful infanticide, Moses was born. I want you to remember that he wasn't called Moses then. It wasn't Jochebed, Moses' mom, who named him Moses. I don't know, I would be fascinated to know what she named him. But it was the princess who gave him the name Moses. And you remember what happened. Moses is her youngest, Jochebed's youngest baby, a baby boy. She put him in an ark of bulrushes, a little ark of bulrushes, put him in the river there in the Nile. And that little ark of bulrushes is going to sink Pharaoh's battleship. But nobody knows it yet. And so the princess starts raising Moses, as you remember, in the palace. I can't conceive of the riches that surrounded this Moses. And I can't spend a lot of time on this, but I want you to get this. I want you to feel this, that this is one of the greatest tributes to motherhood and the power of mother that I have ever seen, that has ever existed. If you raised up a boy in Egypt and you gave him the wealth of the palace and the potential of being higher and higher and higher in the kingdom, you tell me what would be strong enough to ever make him turn his back on that? What is it that would make him give up the riches and go into difficult, a life of difficulty and struggle and never have, once you've tasted of it, once you've tasted of the riches, it is very quick, as we in America have come to realize, that we convert in our minds the difference between luxury and necessity. It all gets kind of foggy on us. We forget what is what. Don't you reckon that happened to Moses? But what is it that was strong enough to get him to turn his back on Egypt? And the answer is, Mama. It was Jochebed. Because Jochebed is there rearing him up, nurturing him in the palace of the king. Doesn't that just take your breath away? I mean, there's going to come a time then when Moses sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. He looks both ways and he goes and he slays that Egyptian. He declared his allegiance, is what he did. Oh, he was powerful in that palace and he was respected in that palace, and people looked at him as an Egyptian, but in his heart he was a Hebrew. He declared his allegiance, that's what he did. And of course then, the next day he realized that this was known and he had to get out because he would be slain for his allegiances. And so he takes off. And then in chapter 3 you have the burning bush. Remember that miracles in the Old and New Testament were designed as signs to make people believe the message, I am that I am. And so God says, Moses, I want you to deliver my people from Pharaoh. What? You don't know. No. You don't want me. It's so interesting to think that Moses is going to go back to places with which he is familiar. You know, it's one thing for you and me to go overseas to preach the gospel. It's another thing to go next door and do it. It's different, right? Right? It's one thing for Moses to go somewhere else and deliver the people, but to go back to the palace, to go back to Egypt to deliver the people. And besides that, he says to the Hebrews, my own people aren't going to believe me. How are they going to? They won't believe me. And so God gives Moses signs that will help them to believe. And so Moses goes with Aaron, who is going to be his spokesman, and he has miraculous signs. All right, now, the Exodus is obstructed. Chapter 5 and verse 2, Pharaoh says, who is the Lord? I don't know it. I don't know your Lord, and why does he know who I am? That's the more important question. And you get a glimpse right now into something that has been a question for people for a long time. And that is, what about these verses that declare that God hardened Pharaoh's heart? Because it seems inconsistent with what we know about God. It just doesn't seem right that God would arbitrarily make a man do wrong so that God could destroy him. That doesn't seem like our God. Well, I don't believe that's accurate at all. It's true that God hardened Pharaoh's heart over and over and over again. The issue is, how did he do it? And I submit to you, it's found here, the heart of it is found here in chapter 5 and verse 2. Are you there? Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I know not the Lord, neither will I let Israel go. You know, a man can become drunk on power. A man can get so accustomed to people obeying his voice that he becomes too, well, you know, my daddy would say he's too big for his own britches, you know. You know how God hardened Pharaoh's heart? He hardened Pharaoh's heart by being God. That's it. He did it by being God. And he would say, through Moses and Aaron, I want you to let my people go that they may worship me in the wilderness, that they may come and worship me. And Pharaoh's attitude was, who do you think you are? What? I know lots of gods. I've got lots of gods. It's not about me knowing him. Does he know who I am? That's a stirring thing for a man to say that to God, isn't it? To stand before God and put your shoulders back and say, do you know who I am? But that's what Pharaoh did. And that's the essence of how God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Comment here. So God brings the plagues. And in chapter 7 through 12. It's interesting to see the evolution of Pharaoh's attitude as these plagues play out. Water turned to blood, frogs, lice, flies, hail, murrain of the cattle, boils, hail, locusts, darkness, death of the firstborn son. That's the last one. And toward the latter half, you have this you have this interesting phenomenon, and it is that Pharaoh wants to compromise. And he'll start saying, okay, look, I know that I am in sin, and you are God's people, and the Lord is God, and I am a sinner. And so, look, I'm going to let you go. And then he throws these compromises. Who knows one of the compromises? What kind of compromise did Pharaoh offer Moses? Yeah. Well, look, you can just let the men go and leave the women and children and flocks here, right? Now, recently in our family Bible study that we do every night, and I was talking about this, and I said, you know, Hannah, there are times in life when it is reasonable and right for us to compromise in matters of indifference or matters of judgment or matters of cooperation with people. We ought to be compromising. We ought to be interested in what other people think. So long as we recognize that there are times, I mean, if it involves doing God's will or not doing God's will, that we cannot compromise. The definition of liberalism is loosing where God has bound. It is an attitude of tolerance to the degree that I would compromise what God has said. He said, this is what I want you to do in Christianity. This is how I want the church to be. And so I give in on some of that because I can unite with other religions, or I can be more favorably seen by others who don't hold the same views. And so you can see how that if Pharaoh said, okay, I'll let the men go, just leave the women and children and flocks behind, that some might be tempted to say, you know what, look, Pharaoh has come a long way, and Pharaoh's changed his attitude, and I think the least we can do is give him some consideration and bend a little bit. We got to work with people, right? What was the answer? No. The answer is no. And God would pop him with another plague. He'd hit him with another one. And so Pharaoh would come up with another compromise. Okay, take care of all the people, but just leave the flocks behind. And Moses' finest hour, Moses said, there shall not be one hoof left behind. I'm not going to compromise with you. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to ask you a question. How many things are there in your life for which you will not compromise? Are there principles? What happens that scares the socks off of me among some young people is that they grow up in this society and they're educated in such a way that the list of things that they wouldn't be willing to compromise somewhat is a very short list. There ought to be things I just will not compromise. I'm a Christian. I wear His name. I want to live for Him. And I will not compromise my principles. I won't. Come what may. Isn't that what Revelation 2 and verse 10 is really saying? Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Unto death means even if it kills you. Some people have a cloth string where they ought to have a backbone, and Pharaoh offered compromises. The plagues are very interesting. You know, various ones. And I tell you what, I'll try to present a lesson soon in which we will examine some of these plagues and how they hit right at the throat of these idolatrous gods in Egypt. I mean, some were aimed at the Egyptian gods like the cows because they had a cow god, and the frogs because they had a frog god, and the sun, because they worship the sun. And there's the darkness, of course. God can flip off the switch if He wants. And, of course, the king. Incidentally, in parenthetical note, and I think that I got this from Haley's Bible Handbook. If you don't have a copy of that little book, it would do you well. Haley's Bible Handbook, and Haley often has interesting details about passages. And I believe that's where I picked this up. He said there are two leading opinions about who Pharaoh was: Amenhotep II or Merneptah. He said there are other two possibilities, but they are of lesser importance. But he says all four mummies have been found. And so, theoretically, it's possible for a person to actually see the face that Moses looked into. All right, now, the Exodus is affected, chapters 12 through 18. In chapter 12, the Passover feast is instituted, and what I think is striking, among other things, is that to prepare for this perpetual feast, they were to sweep all the leaven out of their houses. Now, that's interesting. What is it about leaven that was symbolic enough that He wanted them to get it out of their houses? And the answer is that Cindy likes to make bread. She makes a lot of it. And she has what she calls a starter. I don't know much about it, but it's sticky and it doesn't smell good. That's about as far as I go. But it has a leavening quality to it. And you know, you can make bread using a little bit of yeast, and it doesn't take very much. You put it in a lump of dough and a little bit of yeast, and it rises. And then you can take a pinch of that dough. I'm talking like I know a lot about it. I really don't. But I know you can take a pinch of that and you can put it in another lump and it'll do the same thing to that because it has that quality. Leaven is yeast. So go to chapter 12, verse 15. He's about to finish up these plagues and he says, now this is going to be the Passover and I'm going to pass over the houses and take the life of the firstborn where I don't see the blood on the doorpost and lintel. And this is going to be a perpetual feast for the Israelites so that you can remember. I want this to be a memorial, chapter 12, verse 14. This day shall be unto you a memorial. You shall keep it a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You shall keep it a feast by an ordinance forever. But now look at verse 15. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. Even the first day you shall put away leaven out of your houses. For whosoever eateth leavened bread from the first day unto the seventh day, that soul shall be cut off from Israel. You have a similar statement in chapter 12, verse 19, and in chapter 13, verse 7. I want the leaven out. Now, sometimes people will ask me, isn't it true that you people in the Church of Christ don't believe in the Old Testament? You only believe in the New Testament. And I respond by saying, well, of course we believe in both, but we're not under the Old Testament law, we're under the New Testament law. The Old Testament, Romans 15, 4, was written for our learning. And there's so much that you learn from the Old Testament about God and about sin and about righteousness and the personality of God. But there are also some details, some things that you wouldn't know if you didn't have the Old Testament. For example, when we ate the Lord's Supper this morning, we ate unleavened bread. Why? And what's the point? Why wouldn't loaf bread do just as well? And occasionally you'll see a picture or a print of the Lord's Supper, and they'll have a loaf of Cindy's bread there. It's not really Cindy's, I can promise you that. But it's a loaf of bread. Would it be all right to use leavened bread for the Lord's Supper? No. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 5, Paul plays off of this. When they had a man living in an adulterous relationship in the church, and he says, you've got to deal with this, and here's how to deal with it. And he said, you be careful because a little leaven will leaven the whole lump. You know what that means? You got to put this in check or it's going to permeate. It's going to hurt other people in the church. You'll have a bigger problem. This thing's going to grow if you don't deal with it now. You got to quote Barney Fife, right? You know what Barney would say? What? Thank you. Nip it. You got to nip it in the bud. That's what Paul said. I mean, he didn't use Barney's words, but those weren't Barney's words. But anyway, okay. The leaven had to get out of the house because leaven became symbolic of sin. All right? It was symbolic of sin. And when you and I eat the Lord's Supper, 1 Corinthians chapter 11 says that we examine ourselves and so eat of that bread. And I submit to you that as I do that, it can be a deeply spiritual, must be a deeply spiritual activity in worship because I examine myself and then I eat that unleavened bread. And when I do, I think about the fact that it represents sin. And they were to sweep all the leaven out of their house for the Passover feast. And when Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper, he was at the Passover feast. And that's why he reached and got they didn't have any leaven there. He reached and got unleavened bread. And that's what he gave them to institute the Lord's Supper. And that's what we eat today. And in 1 Corinthians 11, Paul references that again. Comment here. Okay, next week I'm just going to come to class with a list of questions and so you'll talk. Okay, here we go. Okay. Then we get to chapter 15. The Pharaoh says, get out. I want you out. I want you all out. Just go. It was the death of the firstborn that did it. His own magicians and people and advisors had already said, why don't you give this up, Pharaoh? They are the people of God, and God has proved this, and Egypt is destroyed, and you're still persisting. You've got to give it up. Finally, he does, and he says, y'all go. Now, I want you to bear in mind that Egypt was only a great world power for a short amount of time in history. I submit to you, it was that time in which the Hebrews dwelt in Egypt. I don't believe that since that time, Egypt has ever been a significant world power. So the Israelites, or the Hebrews, take the spoils of the Egyptians and they head out. Now they got to eat. And you've got literally millions of Israelites. I don't know how many, maybe 3 million. But you've got a lot of them and they've got to eat. And so God sends manna. Manna is a bread-like cookie, wafer. It's small, it tastes good, and you remember the rules. You could get enough for your family each morning when it came down. And by the way, they also had quail, sometimes quail, for meat. But when the manna comes, you gather enough for that day, but you don't gather more. Because if you do, what will happen to it? It'll spoil, right. There is an exception to that rule, however. That's right. On Friday, you can collect a double portion, which is a fascination to me because it not only fed the people physically, but it fed them spiritually. Because every week, they had a reminder that God was with them. It wasn't just in the sending of the manna, but how it worked. Why would bread of this sort spoil on Monday night and Tuesday night and Wednesday night, but it wouldn't spoil on Friday night? And there was only one answer to that. It was the same bread, only one answer, and that is that God willed it so, and that's why it didn't spoil. And so the people ate manna and also had a reminder from God. Put your string there and jump over with me. Let's see, we got a little bit more time. Jump over with me to John chapter 6, and I want to just point something out to you. You may want to scribble this into your margin in Exodus, but John chapter 6, beginning in verse 31, I can't read all of this, but I just want to point out to you that 31 through 58, that Jesus goes into detail about how He is the bread of life, and He is like that manna. Verse 48, I am the bread of life. Your fathers did eat manna in the wilderness and are dead. This is the bread which cometh down from heaven, that a man may eat thereof and not die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If any man eat of this bread, he shall live forever. And the bread that I will give is my flesh, which I give for the life of the world. So, back to Exodus. You might want to pencil in there John 6, 31 through 58. I think Exodus 16, verse 35. That might be a good place. Exodus 16:35 says, and the children of Israel did eat manna 40 years until they came to a land inhabited, and they did eat manna until they came unto the borders of the land of Canaan. Now the law. We get to chapter 19, and it begins giving them the law, for prepare them for the law. The mountain of Sinai. The people are to wash their clothes, be ready unto the third day, no marital contact with your wives, don't touch the mountain, lest you die. There was thunders and lightning and smoke and an earthquake. And a good friend of mine asked me recently, why the difference between the way that God communicated with His people such as this in the Old Testament and the gentler way that He does in the New Testament, such as in the giving of the Sermon on the Mount. You know, I mean, in the giving of the law of Moses, God came down on the mountain and the people weren't to touch it. And there was lots of thunders and lightnings and it was frightful. And then the Sermon on the Mount comes and Jesus goes up on the mountain and He sits down to teach the people. The people come up to Him. Why did God give the law this way, somebody? Give me an idea.
The old law was a physical law. The new law is spiritual law.
Now, that's not... Yeah, but the old law was spiritual too. I mean, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and Him only shalt thou serve, is spiritual. There's got to be something. I mean, I know that it was a civil law as well as a spiritual law, but why this sternness? I don't even know if that's a good word from God, but why this kind of exhibition of power when it gives the old law as compared to the new? Why? What's the purpose of that? Somebody? Pat? Exodus 20 and verse 20. It says, Moses said unto the people, Fear not, for God is come to prove you, and that His fear may be before your faces, may be before your faces, that you sin not. That nails it. What it has to be is that God, and I know that I sound like a broken record when I say this, but I want to impress you with it. These are slaves coming out of Egypt. They've only known slavery. That's all they've known. And there's a mentality, there's a mental disposition, an attitude that accompanies that, surely. And how in the world is He going to whip them into a respectable nation, a people, His people, that stand with conviction and that fight the battles and do what they've got to do? How is He going to make them into that? And I say that what He does is to get their attention. He jerks them. He says, He makes this giving of the law extremely formal and dramatic and powerful. It is an unmistakable manifestation of the strength of God. And nobody misses it. And what does it accomplish? Well, I reckon it puts fear in the hearts of these people. And there are moral laws. Let's go down through some of the laws now. I won't read all of these, but I want to read a few. On your, can I see your paper? Yeah, okay. I put the verses in there on your outline, and so you might want to read them later. You'll find them very interesting. Let's do, for example, the law on murder. Chapter 21, verse 12. He that smiteth a man so that he die shall surely be put to death. And if a man lie not in wait, but God deliver him into his hand, then I will appoint thee a place whither he shall flee. In other words, if you're innocent, I will make sure that there's a way that you can have a fair hearing. But if a man come presumptuously upon his neighbor and slay him with guile, thou shalt take him from mine altar that he may die. He that smiteth his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Go to chapter 21, verse 28. This is respect for property. And you got to do this too, I think, to form them into a nation. You got to have laws about property and respecting one another's property. So chapter 21 and verse 28 says, If an ox gore a man or a woman that he die, then the ox shall be surely stoned, and his flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be quit. But if the ox were wont to push with his horn in time past, and hath been testified to his owner, and he hath not kept him in, but that he hath killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and his owner also shall be put to death. You're responsible for your own livestock. You're responsible for how it affects other people. And so you can see how a judicial system is being built into the Israelite people so that they can survive as a nation. The old law, the law of Moses that we're looking at, was a religious law, but also their civil law. So you see on your paper there, you have regulations regarding social, religious, and all of these different laws. Now let's go to the tabernacle, chapters 25 through 40. You can read 25 through 31 as I put on your outline there, the design. What you got to be impressed with is the incredible, extreme, minute detail of the tabernacle. And so somebody speculate for me, why? Why did he go to such detail? I mean, it's kind of like the ark, only more. The ark had specifications, 30 cubits, 50 cubits, by, and or pitch it within and without with pitch, gopher wood, one window, one door, all this details. The tabernacle is even more so. Kelly, why?
By paying such attention to the
Excellent. What Kelly said was, by imposing details in the building of the tabernacle, which is the dwelling place of God in a sense, that he's showing them that he's going to pay attention to the details of the rest of his law, that they've got to respect that law. He will pay attention to details. I think that's an excellent point. You know what happens in boot camp, don't you? Now, see, this is like baking bread. I've never been to boot camp, but I've never baked bread. But you know how boot camp is. I've known of parents who had out-of-control teenagers, and they'd send their boy to boot camp. I remember one in particular. He wasn't such a bad boy. I had him in Bible class some, but he didn't have a daddy, and he just seemed like he'd get in trouble. And he got frustrated over a girl that broke his heart, and he tried to take his own life, and he didn't succeed, fortunately. But his mama sent him to boot camp, and when he came back, he was impressive. I remember that day he came to worship that Sunday morning, and he had his uniform on, and he was his countenance was different. And I reached out to shake his hand, and boy, he shook my hand, and he looked me square in the eye, and I said, how you doing? Fine, sir. I loved it. Don't you think that God is working with Israel to say, I want you to shape up, and I am giving you these details from a thundering mountain. Don't you touch that mountain. You do, you die. Right? What are you doing? What's God doing? He's knocking them into a nation. All right, but here comes the problem. Chapters 32 through 34. The tabernacle is delayed. Chapter 32. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, Up, make us gods. Where did they get that idea? Somebody? From Egypt. They'd seen it so commonly. Make us gods, which shall go before us, for as for this Moses, oh, doesn't that hurt you? As for this Moses, it's kind of a mockery. The man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we know not what has become of him. And Aaron, who, by the way, is Moses' older brother, said unto them, Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, of your sons, of your daughters, and bring them unto me. Where did they get those earrings? Egypt. The people break off the earrings, and Aaron, first earring, two bells? Okay, that's the first bell. Okay. So they make a golden calf. And they say, Aaron says, this is the God that brought you out of Egypt. And so it gets kind of weird. I mean, it's as if we're accustomed to having a God we can look at. And so we'll make him now that we can. This calf represents the God that brought us up out of Egypt. And now we will worship the tangible, the worship what we can see. This pitiful apostasy in Exodus happened right after the thunderings of the mountain. And I want you to see, ladies and gentlemen, the power of false religion on people. What they were practicing was religion, but it was false religion. And incidentally, it involved a loosening of the restraints which God had placed on them because they worshiped it, and then the Bible says they rose up to play. And go ahead and use your imagination about that, and I'm sure you'll get it right. So God punishes them immediately in chapter 32, verse 28. God says, Moses, I'm going to just destroy them, and I'll make a nation from you. And Moses says in chapter 32, verse 31 and 32, Moses says, Now God, What will other people say, other nations? You've delivered them out of Egyptian bondage. What will other nations say? And then Moses makes a dramatic statement that he shouldn't have made. If you do this, just go ahead and blot my name out of your book. God was very patient with Moses. God really loved Moses, or he'd have smitten him right then. But God says, in essence, Moses, I keep the books. I keep the books. And then it was completed, chapter 35 through 40. When you read those chapters, you'll find again the extreme detail of the tabernacle, which was commanded and followed. The Holy of Holies was a perfect cube, 15 feet. And Hebrews 9:24 says that it's a shadow of heaven. For Christ is not entered into the holy places made with hands, which are the figures of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. This tabernacle was largely imitated when the temple was built. Okay, there's the book of Exodus. It describes a people. We started in Genesis and we came up with a Jacob and we came up with a Joseph. And Joseph brings his people to Egypt. And then they make into a nation. And when we say Israelites, remember that Joseph's daddy is Jacob. Jacob's name was changed to Israel. And so the Israelites are descendants of Jacob. Exodus delivers them out of Egyptian bondage and it's the beginnings of hammering them into a nation. When we get to Leviticus, we're going to see the law spread out before us. And it's going to be fascinating as we progress, learning more about the people from which eventually the Christ will be born. If you don't have a copy of the binder and you want one, there should still be some back there. We have more copies of today's outline right here. Right, Tony? Good. Right here. And last week's are up on the front seat. If you want to just remain in your seat, the meeting with the elders is just about to begin in 2 or 3 minutes.